What is up, guys? You are listening to Otaku Spirit Anime Cast. My name is Andrew, and I'm joined here with Chris. In today's episode, we are going to be covering more of the fall 2022 anime season reviews. Been going through the final half of all the shows and give our perspective on each one of them. As per usual, that we're at otakuspirit.com. It's where you can find all of our links, social media links, Discord links, way to support us, Patreon, tips link, all that good stuff. Again, we're at YouTube at youtube.com/otakuspirit. But yes, let's dive right back into the list. My Life After I Became a Dunnyhead Mike One Morning. Did you watch this one?
Nope.
Super short. You could have like consumed it in 2 seconds.
I watched a couple of episodes.
Yeah, this one was done by ENGI. It's like a, what was it, like 3 minute shorts, maybe 5 minute shorts. Very, very short series. It's essentially, it was presented as an ASMR show with the whole idea of the dummy head microphone, and you put the headphones in and they talk in one ear and one ear or the other, and they do like popping noises and stuff in your ears. It's to simulate the first person perspective of these characters talking in your ears. They didn't really do anything with that. ENGI learned nothing from the last time. The ENGI also did the other one, which was the what was the other one called? I forget what it was called.
It was just 180 seconds.
Yeah, can I make your ears happy in 180 seconds? And they had the same problem there as they did here, where literally 99% of the show is recorded with a regular studio into a single microphone mono. And then every now and then they'll record something with a dummy head microphone to make you have a brief moment of a whispering in one ear or the other, which is unfortunate. Though I will say the writing in this one compared to 180 seconds was much better. 180 seconds was great because they had that one episode with the two sisters that were talking about how they can poison this their brother's boyfriend or girlfriend. This one was like, you had this concept of a reincarnation of somebody, not just anybody, but yes, the voice of Rudeus from Mushoku Tensei Java's Reincarnation, which made this like 100 times better because I just imagined Rudeus being reincarnated into a bunch of random stuff the entire show. Some episodes were really clever in that regard because every episode he reincarnates into something else, except like two episodes was dummy heads. The rest of it was like one episode was he turned into a chicken and the chicken gets fried into chicken, fried chicken, and then the girls eat the fried chicken. One time he's a bike seat and then the girl sits on his bike seat. That kind of stuff throughout the entire thing. A pillow one time, bunch of just random stuff. And I think for that absurdity, it was kind of funny. The girls were cute. Some of the interactions between some of the girls were cute. There was a little element of a lot of elements of Yuri, especially with Panda, who's just madly in love with Yuri, which, yes, her name's Yuri. Ume was in love with Panda, so there's a little bit of love triangle there. They had a little sister injected at some point. They had this one student council president who was in love with her senpai or something, or teacher or something like that. Bunch of really random, goofy stuff, but it was, for a really quick short, it was humorous in that regard. I think I said it my first impressions, and I'm pretty much on the same page now. The only suggestion I really have is if you watch Mushoku Tensei Java's Reincarnation and you love Rudeus's voice, watch this thinking that it's Rudeus and it makes it fun, and then throw it away. That's really all it is. So yeah, it's not like a go out of your way show. So yeah, that's My Life After I Became a Dummyhead Microphone One Morning. Once again, ENGI, you suck at ASMR. I mean, I've never experienced ASMR, and I'm not really, at least the effect of it, but at least I know how stereo recording works, and you fail miserably at it. You're not good at it. And record the whole thing with the dummy head or don't. Granted, you can't really record dummy head mic if it's the seat of a bike or chicken, but you get my point. Did you finish this one?
Yes.
Okay, More Than a Married Couple, But Not Lovers. This one's streaming on Crunchyroll for 12 episodes, done by Studio Mother. Your mother did it. Source is a manga, and the series composition by Naruhisa Arakawa, who did Art Club Has a Problem, Island, Let's Make a Mug 2, and Outbreak Company. And this one opens up with Jiro, who really likes his childhood friend Shiori, and he really doesn't like this Gyaru girl from his school who hates him as well, which is Akari Watanabe. Akari Watanabe really likes the school prince, which was in Minami, right?
Yeah.
Minami Tenjin.
Pretty much.
And so this school, I think it's just this school, and maybe all the schools, it's Japan thing. So they're trying to fix the birth rate. So they put the schools through this whole marriage system where they pair two students together. They live together in a house. They have locks on their each separate rooms. and they monitor their existence inside of this house together as a married couple. And the better they perform being a married couple, the more points they get, the higher rank they get. And the more ranks you get, the better grade you get. They also have the system where the highest ranked members can then, with the consent of the other parties, swap married couples, which, why does that help you learn marriage? We're going to overlook that because it's a staple in the storyline. You have to have that present, even though it's terrible for teaching people marriage. But yeah, obviously, I set it up for you already. Everybody knows what's going to happen. Zero ends up with the Gyaru that don't like each other. And yes, his childhood friend ends up with the beautiful prince boy of the school. So yeah, they kind of had to work together to improve their score, and I'm assuming over time learning doki dokis with each other. Your thoughts or your review?
I actually really enjoyed this. It's one of those. I had at one point I got as I was going through a lot of manga. I bumped into a show that a while ago we ended up getting.
Love and Lies.
Love and Lies. That's what it was. And I thought I liked the concept of that one, and I really wanted to kind of finish it, but I never did. And this one has a very similar concept in the basically the you have a love interest that you really wanted to be with, but for whatever reason you're kind of shoehorn forced into a relationship with another person. And this one does that as well. After all said and done, Love and Lies didn't quite work as good as I wanted it to. However, this one pulled it off as good as can be expected. Where it actually feels like a natural progression of a relationship between Jiro and Watanabe. And I give them a lot of props for that. Yes, the ultimate conclusion, it felt like a chapter in, and they did pretty solidly in revealing, okay, now what are they going to do? You have the, okay, now what? And it of course is going to lead to the idea of, are they going to do this or that? When all, is all said and done, they're going to be forced with a decision after the point of the end of this core. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. I thought a lot of the interactions felt pretty natural, and it was a definite forward moving of the relationship and the forcing of the triangle to be in the forefront of these characters' minds. So yeah, I really like how all this was said and done and it was presented, and I highly suggest it, especially if you're into the love triangle aspect.
And ecchi.
Ecchi. Well, the ecchi wasn't as strong as...
They did it heavy at the beginning. They wanted to sell some ecchi at the beginning. Lots of Watanabe panty shots. But I mean, that was kind of what they were going through, is having Jiro being this kind of like super virgin of like, whoa, 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 whoa. I'm more than a married couple, but not lovers. Check that out. Do you want to skip love flops? I just want to skip love flops. Love flops, High Dive, 12 episodes, Passione Studio, original writing by Ryo Yasumoto, who did Steins Gate Zero script work. Director Nobuyoshi Nagayama, who did My Girlfriend is Shobi, Are You Lost, Life Lessons, and Smile Down the Runway. And Happy Sugar Life, too. That's relevant. Yeah, Love Flops takes place in a very slightly futuristic world of increased AI technologies and stuff like that. And we follow a guy named Asahi Kashiwagi, who at some points gets a news report about, or was it was a news report, and at some point they had like a fortune-telling segment where they talked about all these different things. If this is your birthday, then look out for these things. And sure enough, it was his, and it talked about like a stairwell, a train, and all these other things. And sure enough, as he goes to school, each one of these things come up at some point at his travel to school, and he ends up running into a girl in an inappropriate way at the same time. Like the stairwell... this character and girl flies off the top of the stairwell, somehow clears like 50 feet and lands with her crotch in his face. This dog was one of them, attacks this poor Ilya and humps her. And this robot stole this girl's bra, and the train, this Mungfa girl, like, fell on him, and this tree and stuff. Anyways.
By the way.
First episode spoiled. The entire first episode is pretty much just running into each one of these girls in inappropriate ways, and then pretty much the second episode is trying to correct their impression of him by apologizing or trying to clear up the misunderstandings, and then they all end up at his house because harem, and somebody's obviously pulling some strings. His dad leaves a message saying that, you know, you're going to live with all these girls, they have nowhere to stay, and one of them become your wife, your bride, whatever, groom, too. Yeah, that's the opening of Love Flops. Thoughts?
This show did well.
Not bad.
This show did well in the etchy aspect in the first few episodes.
Sorry. That just got me.
When it tried to get serious, it failed miserably. That's giving it a lot of credit, because when me and Andrew were talking about it earlier, he was pointing out the fact of I kind of wish I didn't watch the last few episodes, and I said, yeah, I pretty much, he was talking about when he checked out, and I'm like, yeah, I checked out when it started doing the go on ahead type thing, and I was like,
the final dungeon trope.
You didn't do that. Please don't do that. Why are you doing that? It's frustrating, because I was having a good time in the first few episodes. I really liked it. I thought that the ecchi was fantastic. I thought the goofy tropes were funny as all get out. And so, yeah, and trying to incorporate different aspects, we had an entire magical girl episode where we were trying to incorporate the ecchi aspect along with the magical girl, and the contrast was absolutely too much fun. When we did one episode with a, let's just say, Tengu.
The Tengu was the only good episode. The Tengu was the only good episode.
I thought that was absolutely brilliantly done. That was
so crazy.
I had a lot of fun in the first few episodes, but when the story started trying to get serious, and this is the mark of when they actually, and this is my biggest frustration. I almost feel like they didn't know how to
transition.
Yeah. to give a lot of leeway. The first episode of when they started getting serious was marked by the realization that everything that they knew, that the main character knew, was fake. And he spent all of an entire episode complaining about the fact that he had this realization, or he was going through this realization, only to go, okay, I'm going. Why did you fight it so hard for that whole entire episode just to go, okay? No, it doesn't work like that. You don't just, okay.
What was it?
Okay. Andrew does it better.
Okay. Okay.
But yeah, I'm ultimately very, very frustrated with the show. Loved the first few episodes, hated the last few episodes. That's my ultimate review.
Yeah, the struggle with this series is I do kind of agree with you, and I think it's something I've been trying to put my finger on for a while now. Is let me perfectly clear. The first episode was pretty fun. The Tengu episode was hilarious. It was absurd as hell. Amelia's episode was just cute. It was all right. Keren's episode was like the point where I'm like, okay, I know what the story's doing. Like Keren's episode, if Mungfa almost got me there, but Keren's episode, I'm like, okay, I know what exactly is happening here. And so I think that's maybe why it didn't shock me as much. But I do agree that I think the transition wasn't really well done, because we've watched other shows where it goes from ecchi to serious, like Punchline, that pulls it off so well. This one just didn't. And And I think that's because I kind of checked out really quickly, and that the progression of that story just didn't really feel all that impactful. And I wasn't one given really much time to really care. There's too many of these girls, and there's too little time to really get to know them. And then so I'm supposed to feel bad for them. And I didn't care about Asahi, to be honest. I just really didn't feel like he was that likable of a character overall. Like, he's not likable. And there's nothing about him that makes him feel unique or interesting at all. He just feels like a blank main character in the middle of a harem, and then I'm supposed to really care about what he's feeling. And it really sucks because, honestly, the final plot line is kind of tragic. It kind of sucks, but at the same time, I didn't really feel enough for them to really care. So, I don't know. I made a whole video on how I felt about the turning point of the series, that if I thought it worked or not, and if I feel it was going to be able to nail it or not. And I think I expressed most of my feelings there in a spoilery way, if you guys want to check that out. But in the end, I just didn't care. And again, I think the other problem I'm having is most of the harem ecchi stuff early on didn't really feel... It felt very Western crude. Is that a good way to put it? Like, it didn't feel like Japanese comedy. It felt like they were trying to be Western edgy. Like, I mean, the whole gag toys and the obsession with condoms and stuff like that, it just felt very Western in the comedy, and it didn't really feel like, I don't know, it didn't feel like Japanese comedy. And it's not that that makes it bad, it just makes it feel not natural in the setting of an anime show, and it feels like they're trying to do it, and it's like, you're not really doing that right. That was kind of what the feeling I was getting, especially with, like, Kenan's episode. I was like, yeah, this kind of feels like Western comedy. And, yeah, I think Mangfa as well, but I don't know. It overall just didn't work. The character designs are cute. The seiyus are fantastic, but that's about all I can really give the series, unfortunately. So, which sucks, because I think the PV and the previews that we got were like, holy crap, this could be really good. But then, it's an original. Sometimes that... flops.
Mm-hmm.
Wap, 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 wap. Anyways, that's Love Flops. Let's talk about... I'm pretty sure we can both agree on this one.
Probably.
Let's talk positively about a show. Because we're going to go right into another negative. Anyways, Reincarnated as a Sword. This one streamed on High Diver for 12 episodes. Done by Studio C2C. Source is light novel. Director is Shinji Ishihira, who did Tsukimichi Moonlit Fantasy, Log Horizon, and Fairy Tale. But this one opens up with a guy that gets reincarnated into another world, but not as a warrior, an OP character, a harem protagonist, or a cute cat girl. No, he gets reincarnated as a sword. And he's on a mount, on a monument, and he is like, oh crap, what the heck's going on? Why am I a sword? Eventually, some goblins come by to try to pick him up, and he figures out that he can use telekinesis to move, so he kills the goblins. Realize that if he hits the core of the monsters, he gets, like, skills from them, and he's able to apply these skills to himself, and so he starts taking out a bunch of monsters nearby, thinking, man, one day somebody's gonna pick me up and be overpowered, because I got a ton of skills to apply, and he can technically transfer his abilities and strengths to whoever wields them. Eventually, he ends up landing into this big dead forest, where he realizes the mana from the soil is absorbing his mana, so he can't move. And so he's stuck there for a long time until, yes, insert Dotaru of the year, possibly century, Fran, who is currently being forced to work by this group of people. They have these collars on her and forcing her to do labor. And at some point it gets attacked. Their carriage going by there gets attacked by this big two-headed bear. And in a ditch effort to try to save herself and people around her, she sees the sword sitting there, picks him up, gains all of his abilities, is able to talk to him through touching, and absorbs all of his abilities and takes out the bear. And then he then proceeds to break her collar, burns his her master's contract, and then kills him. So she's free to travel by herself. The story you get from the side is that, yes, Fran is of this black cat tribe. The black cat tribe of all the beast tribes is looked down upon as being like garbage, basically. They're the only tribe that they don't evolve, whereas all the other tribes they evolve over time. Her parents at some point were trying to go on a journey to evolve, and they failed and died, and now Fran wants to essentially pick up their legacy. She wants to do what their parents did, were trying to do, which is to evolve. Get stronger enough that she can evolve as a black cat. And so her and the sword, which she calls Shisho, travel and join the Adventure Guild and are massively OP. And Fran goes, "Sugoi, Shisho." And she's super cute. Thoughts?
On and
my
curry.
On my next life with my daughter, Rue, Fran.
Don't forget about curry.
Mm-hmm.
I love the show. I really enjoy the it was a little bit rough at the beginning, but that aside,
are you jumping on my
criticism? I'm jumping on you because I know you're gonna come in and you're gonna go on to
geez, you're so negative, Chris. God, why it was great.
I acknowledge that it felt very it took a while to get to the point with Shisho at the beginning. And I acknowledge that, but at the same time, it didn't feel as bad as Spider and Spider Slime.
I don't know. Yeah, I guess
Slime I don't think Slime was as bad as Spider. Spider was probably the worst. Honestly,
didn't he absorb like an entire and like it wasn't in Slime? Didn't he like absorb things the entire first episode? And at the very end, he ran into the dragon.
The dragon.
Beginning of the second episode was when he talked to the dragon.
Pretty much.
So Slime had a whole episode of it,
and Spider was Spider just had about
like
as bad.
Five. Spider had like five.
But Shisho, I think it got through that. What felt like it seems like it took about half the episode, and the other half was Fran getting him, and then ultimately defeating the bear. It's one of those. I acknowledge
the bear. Get it right.
I acknowledge what Andrew points out, and
I got so much heat for that. I'm like, I watched two episodes. Here's my first impressions. I didn't like the first episode because half of it was him just training. Everybody got angry at me. I'm like, okay,
it's one of those that you have to acknowledge it. I mean, it is one of those things.
The only reason I say that is because I don't want somebody to go start watching this show and have the same feeling I am going, this show's not fun. I'm just watching him kill things and slice diamonds. I'm letting people know that so that they know, just if you don't like that, get past it. That's all. It's a warning. Anyways,
it's one of those that you can see it and you're like, okay, I understand what Andrew was talking about, because it does become repetitive. I mean, that is, if you acknowledge that, that's all you're saying is you acknowledge that this is something that is there. Some people it'll bother more than other people, and that's one of those things. I believe it's more along the lines of setting up for why is he so overpowered. I acknowledge the montage of it. That's the frustrating thing, is the montage of it is the downside. Is him constantly, all it's showing is him doing the little spinny attack thing, and then he pretty much chops the goblin's head in half or whatever have you, blows up a gym, and then it's on his skill list. Now, either they can just say, well, he did, the announcer can say, well, he did that for 25 years and he has this list of skills, or he can actually show you something that's actually moving on the screen. Whether you think it's moving or not is irrelevant. CGI sword. Either way, this is taking too long. He meets up with Fran, and I absolutely fell in love with Fran very fast. She is the type of character that has that kind of underdog tone, but at the same time with Shisho, she becomes effectively overpowered. So the downside to this is that she becomes this kind of, in a way, this go-getter type character, but she does have that dark past that does keep her in her shell. So this actually works to her benefit as the, like Andrew had mentioned, the daughter of the season, where you actually want to see her protected. On the flip side, this also becomes a issue later, which I hope that eventually this will be addressed in a latter part of the story, which I would hope that we're getting more of this.
We have a season two announced.
Great. It's one of those that I do really want to see addressed at some point, where, because at some point let's just say she got separated from the sword. She became in this really frustrating situation where she did fight to move forward, but she was also hindered because she didn't have him. And I want to see that addressed. And that's not a bad thing. That's actually a good thing.
This series is literally codependency.
Yes. And I think that it's a good thing that she does have this striving for getting better in her own right. And yet she does love Shisho and does acknowledge Shisho as this very important figure in her life. So her not having him for a short while showed her that she is very dependent on him and she needs him. But at the same time, for her to grow in herself, she needs to be able to grow outside of him as well. And I think that that's something that needs to be addressed. And I think that it's a very good thing of her to grow on her own.
But I think it's important to kind of note the idea that she is still kind of immature in a lot of that regard. So I do kind of appreciate the fact that she doesn't think that stuff. She does in the moment go, crap, I'm nothing without him. Wait, I can do something. He's told me in the past that I can do this. And so it pushes her to go forward. She doesn't want to let Shisho down. But I think her dwelling on it too much is her not dwelling on it too much is a sign that, yes, she's still technically immature. She's still a child, technically.
And that's what I'm saying. I'm acknowledging it. I think it's a really good thing that she has so much growth to make. And this story does seem to focus in on the growth of these characters and them changing over time. And either way, I think it's a fantastic show. And I really, really am excited about the idea of more in the future.
Yeah, this is I think probably one of the biggest shocks of fall for me easily is the show that every single week I just look forward to watching it. There was never a time that I watched a show that I'm like not completely invested in just seeing Fran happy, doing good things. And it was funny because, yes, I mean, I'm not going to get too heavy into it again. It's just to warn people. Yes, not liking the first part of the first episode. I think what fixed it for me was the fact that the moment that Fran shows up, yes, the music ramps up. Music's freaking great. They got this rock music playing with some chorus in the background. She's jumping around this bear, sliding underneath it and slicing it up with this big old sword that's like literally like taller than she is. It was fantastic. But what was great, what the chemistry hit then, obviously. That's the chemistry. It's Shisho and Fran, obviously. With that chemistry, it made everything work. Because what happens then from that point on is that anytime you have those moments where they're slicing things and getting skills, what happens? Shisho gets to talking about it, or some character in this story, the guildmaster is talking about something important, and guess what? The moment it gets too drawn out, what happens? Fran looks bored, and they suddenly stop. Like, Fran becomes a thing to say, all right, We acknowledge we're going a little bit too long. Fran's gotten bored because Fran is no nonsense. She is, okay, what is it? Oh, I want that. Oh, what is it? Okay, just give it to me. Well, this thing right here, I want it. That's what she is. She is, again, very immature. She wants something. She wants it now. She wants to move forward. She doesn't want the long, drawn-out dialogue. She is what's keeping kind of the story and the exposition in check. And I think they do it so well. Like, the writer is so good at getting that exposition to the point where it just goes stop. And that might be because the light novel goes into detail, but then in the anime, they're just using her as a way of kind of going, yeah, that's about as far we're going to get there. Let's move on. But it either way, it works. And I really love it. But no, I kind of alluded to when I interject at some point with Chris going through it is I think this show is, like, top-notch, a great portrayal of this concept of codependency and the idea that you have power in Shisho, but Shisho can't do anything by himself. And he doesn't know about the world itself. So what's his avenue? Fran. Fran is the one that's going to show him, take him around, and wield him to do things. At the same time, Fran needs protecting. She is fragile. She is human. She is mortal. She needs protection of Shisho. So they're constantly at protecting each other. And yes, Shisho is trying to at least guide and protect Fran because she is technically still young and she is innocent. But at the same time, this is the world that he can't really put his own morals on. There's a point where it gets kind of really dark, and Shisho has to stop himself. He's going, wait, I can't let her do this. Let me do it. And she doesn't want to, she doesn't want him to do it. And then he realizes, oh, I'm using morals from the other world here. It doesn't work here. This is what she has chosen. This is what, this is the world that we're in. And I thought that was kind of really, I respect the writer for willing to go that direction with it, because that's that point which you really do realize that in the end, this is this world. Yes, she does look young, but this is something that she feels that she has to do based on what has happened with her clan. They hit on it really quickly with like their first introduction to the guild, is that you have these people going up and saying, oh, look, it's a black cat. We kill those black cats all the time out in the battlefield. We burn their bodies, all that kind of stuff. It's like the stuff that they're, that hit her family has gone, or her clan has gone through, is absolutely horrific. So, yeah, overall, though, I think every episode just nails the codependency, nails Fran's cuteness. It nails, like, Fran is not just cute. Fran is not just Dotaru. She's multifaceted. In the wake of her being innocence, basically, you have determination and push to grow through tragedy. This is a girl that is passionate about what she does. She's very, you could say that she's very narrow-minded. She's very focused. She pushes herself, often pushes herself too much. And I love the willingness of the writer to say every now and then, all right, chill, friend. Like, you've hit a barrier. You hit a barrier. Stop. And Shisho constantly saying, you got to stop eventually. You got to stop eventually. She is so driven, so determined. She will march head on. And yes, it often comes a point where she runs into those roadblocks and it kind of shoves dirt in her face. But then she stands up again. She keeps pushing forward. And I think the way that they've managed to put together Fran as a character, outside of just being this absolutely adorable cat girl, Dotaru, she's fantastic. I think she is just a really treasured character of the year. And I absolutely love the series for that. But outside of that, I will admit there's points where it just doesn't kind of work. There's some of the side characters don't work. I think, I don't put her name down here. The character they introduced later on in the series, I think at first I didn't think I was going to like her character, but then, yeah, love that character.
I was going to say, I really love that character.
She didn't work for me at first. She was just kind of the overly, like, mama doting, question mark what she's doing kind of character, but they really nailed her character. But yeah, I really, really can't wait for more. I was super mad at the ending because it almost felt like one of those, like it was like a 10-second segment that literally said, check out the source material. But no, it was literally them teasing the second season. So I'm like, okay, good. if this was the ending of the anime adaptation, I'd be super mad. But when they finally announced another season, I'm like, okay, good. That was totally a Spirit Chronicles ending, with the cliffhanger. Yeah, I'm looking forward to more. Really fantastic. Love our new outfit, by the way, at the very end, too.
Right.
Daughter of the season. Check out Reincarnated as a Sword. Fun little... I do appreciate, again, a different take on Isekai, because it is the object Isekai, which is apparently very popular in light novels right now. But just the aspect of... Not so much that he is Isekai'd as a sword, but it basically being an empowerment Isekai. That he is the avenue for helping somebody else be the main character. So you essentially have Fran is the main character of the story in that world, but he is the silent protagonist that is enabling her. So cool. It's cool stuff. So let's move on to Akiba Made War. Streaming on High Dive for 12 episodes, done by PA Works, an original being produced by Cygames and Dugout. This one was directed by Shuichiro Masui, who did Sakura Quest. That makes sense. Rascal Does Not Dream About Bunny Girl Senpai. So this one opens up in Akiba, where there's maids. They have maid cafes. They're themed cafes, really cutesy. You can go to a pig cafe. You can go to a space invader cafe, a sheep cafe, whatever. And then inside there, you can get served really overpriced food with moi moi kyun enchantments on them. And we follow Nagami, who has just arrived in Akiba, and she's so excited to become a maid and serve at a cafe. She's got a new job at Tontokaton, which is a pig cafe, and she arrives there, and she starts her first day alongside Ronko, who is a 36-year-old that's become a maid, which is kind of weird, but they go with it. And, quickly they have this guy come by, and he's collecting his quote-unquote sweets, which is pretty much payment to their big corporation head, Creature Land. And if they don't pay their sweets, they're going to, something bad's going to happen to them. And then they basically are, Nagami gets told to go take a letter to a nearby cafe, which is, ends up being a competitor to Creature Lands. And you pretty much find out from that point that the letter was to make them mad so that they would start a fight. And Ranko went with her, so she shot everybody. Yeah, it's basically Yakuza slash territory wars between maids, and everybody kills each other. Your thoughts on Akiba Maid War?
This show was 30 million minutes of brilliance.
24 minutes, Chris.
24 million minutes of brilliance.
Unless you had a 6 minute somewhere else that you really liked.
Yeah, this show was 24 minutes of pure brilliance.
The first episode is amazing. I got a huge kick out of the producer of PA Works that went somewhere else. He tweeted, like, what happened to my previous co-workers of PA Works? I'm scared. I'm like, you watched the first episode, didn't you? Yep. Yeah, I don't know if I want to say anything because I got one of my most disliked videos on YouTube is my review of Akiba Maid War. So apparently the ratio is pretty high, but I think some people respect my opinion and still did like button. So I don't know. I think I'm.
Well, there was more than the first 24 minutes.
The what?
There's more than one episode of the show.
Yeah, some would say unfortunately.
Oh, I forgot.
The first episode is incredible. If you're not getting our joke already, the first episode is brilliance. It's a great contrast between violence and comedy, and this whole montage of Yumich, who is this like pigtail girl. She's doing a dance on the stage at their cafe. The same time, Ronko's over there shooting a bunch of maids in the middle of the street, doing dance routines like a maid would do, and using the guns as like light sticks. And it was perfect. Like, the music was perfectly cued with each of the actions happening on the screen. It was absolute visual audio artistry brilliance. For me, the only good episode.
Yeah, and that outside of the joke, I mean, that's about where I stand with it. I wanted this show to work. And I remember specifically that after that first episode, me and Andrew both mentioning that I don't know how they can top that. Either they have to go more extreme or everything's going to fall. And it literally ended up the same way. I mean, yeah, you could see the jokes here and there, but none of them hit, at least for me. It felt like I never could get to that same level again. That contrast was so brilliantly done. I did not finish the show, to be fair. I got to the climbing up the animal thing and the one particular group.
He didn't like that one guy dying. That's why he stopped watching.
I don't know which one guy you're talking about. We'll go with it. But yeah, it's one of those things of, like,
they took out my favorite character. I'm stopping watching.
Oh. Didn't know that happened, but we'll go with it.
Let's pay attention. Or maybe that wasn't the next episode. Maybe that was. No, because I think it was like right at the end. Anyways.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay, I got you. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Because he was trying to help out his girl.
But no, I didn't much care for it, and so it was an easy one for me to let go. But that's just me being fair. It wasn't working. I love the first episode. I think I would put it in the top 10 of all of my favorite single episodes of all time. It was that brilliant.
Yeah. And that was the shock value aspect. It wasn't just shock value. Like I said, it was just really well presented because we knew that it wasn't really shock value because the first few minutes of the episode shows somebody get shot. So, you know, that's not a shock value. It was just how it put it together. And my argument that I've made is just that I feel like there's two aspects here. One is comedy subjective. And yes, part of the show is comedy. I've seen a lot of people that said, no, I really love the show all the way through. And I thought the comedy was great. I'm like, okay, well, obviously, if I didn't see the comedy, like the like beyond like the third episode or something, I didn't laugh at all until like this one point where Ronko goes to bow to somebody and the elevator door closes on her head and she goes, ugh, and she falls over. I'm like, that was so out of character for Ronko. It was hilarious. I laughed out loud. But it wasn't working outside of that. So if people were still laughing all the way to the end, obviously I wasn't getting the joke. And maybe that's why I didn't enjoy it overall. But I just really feel like for the earlier segments, it felt like they were trying to reuse that first episode joke and the idea that they have a problem, they go to another cafe, they get in trouble, Ronko shoots everything. They go to another cafe, they get in trouble, Ronko shoots everything or blows things up. And so it was never creative with it. I mean, I think the only other part that was kind of creative was the whole aspect of the training boot camp, which was kind of funny, but
yeah,
it just never... Yeah, not so much the idea that never hit the high of the first episode, because I never really expected that. I was like, I need to set my expectations, because I don't think they're going to nail that again. It just never did anything for me personally that worked. It just turned... It kind of, and especially later on, just turns into a Yakuza story. It just turns into a gang violent story, and it... didn't really work for me in that regard, especially with Nagami. Nagami's character was just all over the place. Anyways, yeah, it just didn't work. It worked for a lot of people, obviously, because I'm literally feel like I'm the oddball out, so don't take my word for it.
Well, I fully acknowledge it's trying to capitalize on that contrast between the Yakuza area with the contrasting cutesy moe maid thing. And it worked in that first episode, but it never captures that essence again. All they do is they just keep trying to push the edge farther and farther out, but they went the wrong direction. It wasn't the become more and more edgy. They needed to capitalize on the moe aspect and make it offset the darkness that you're talking about, for lack of a better term. They're trying to get darker and hoping that the cutesy moe will hold that contrast, and it's the opposite. You needed to capitalize on the cutesy moe, and oh yeah, by the way, it's dark. And yeah. And
it was too in the face about the violence and the serious
effectively
tone.
Yeah.
That is Akiba Maid War. Again, I've seen a lot of people love it. Of course, that's like everything. If we don't like it, people still enjoy it. So
yeah, there's nothing wrong with enjoying the show.
We're not the only people in the world. It just didn't work for us. Do it yourself. This series was streaming on Crunchyroll for 12 episodes, done by Studio Pine Jam. The source is an original. The genres are slice of life. The director is Kazuhiro Yoneda, who did Kageki Shoujo and Hozuki's Cool Headedness. Series composition and script by Kazuyuki Fudiyasu, who did Slime, Land of the Dale, Encouragement to Climb, Girls Last Tour, and Mojunkie. And character designs by Yusuki Matsuo, who did Encouragement of Climb. So... Chris, you informed me that you didn't finish it.
I didn't finish it.
Oh, it's like literally anime of the year contender for Andrew. I feel bad that Chris missed out on. How far did you get into it? They start the treehouse?
Yeah, they started the treehouse. They went to the hardware store to get parts.
Did the truck-kun incident happen?
No.
No.
I don't know what Chuck Coon, unless it's something that may have happened that I didn't recognize. So,
yeah, not that kind of Chuck Coon. I don't want to give people the wrong impression. Just a Chuck Coon did something terrible. anyways, no, I absolutely love this show. This essentially opens up with Yua Setafu, and she is about to start her new year in school at her new school. And much to the disappointment of her childhood friend and neighbor, Putin, she did not go to the same school that Putin was applying to. Messed up, apparently. Putin is going to, like, this high-tech school that kind of surrounds the school that Yua Setafu is going to. The high-tech school trains things like 3D printing and design and stuff like that. They literally 3D print usable arteries. That's how crazy it is. Whereas Yua Setafu is going to the smaller school that just is more about history and learning about mundane stuff, apparently. Not the cool prestige school. And I think that's the difficulty for Putin, is that she does, obviously, she's tsundere, but she does like Yua Setafu, but feels that Yua Setafu gets too stuck in the clouds and doesn't realize that her future is ahead of her, and Putin, I think, wanted her to get the best schooling possible for her future. But anyways, Yua Setafu heads to her school. gets entered all the time. She has a perfect record at or perfect attendance going to the infirmary to get bandages put on her face because she always runs into stuff. She's, again, head's always in the clouds. One day at school, going to school, she ends up running into a pole and messing up her bike. But this this club leader of the do-it-yourself club of that school drops by and fixes her bike and then leaves. And Yuasa Setafu, wanting to thank her for fixing her bike, goes to the do-it-yourself club where she ends up learning about do-it-yourself and actually ends up joining. And then we kind of have, from this point on, is you have different characters around Yuasa Setafu, like Takumin, who ends up joining as well. She's into kind of arts and craft kind of stuff. Then you know, later on, you have the arrival of Shi, who is like a foreign exchange student that's super energetic. She's like ninja. Jobco calls her ninja because she jumps around on the... She jumps down from the bigger building of the other school all the way down to the do-it-yourself club roof and then through the trees and down into the club itself. So she calls her ninja. But she's super energetic and has a lot of strength. And then, yes, the arrival of Jobco, which... Best girl of the show, Jobco. I love Jobco. She's like a... She's the daughter of a CEO of a big tech corporation who... And she was supposed to go to the school that Putin's going to, but she wrote the characters wrong. Because, like, in, like, Katakana, like, one character being wrong is the admission of the other school. So she messed that up. But, yeah. That's the kind of the gist of it. Over time, they kind of work together to make crafts and stuff like that and come together and all that kind of stuff. So, yes, like I said earlier, this show was, I think it was my number one of fall of 2022, of show of 2022, fall 2022. I think it was like at the tail end of my favorite of the year in my top 10 of 2022. I absolutely adore this show. Coming into it, I expected it just to be cute girls doing cute things with do-it-yourself. And I love do-it-yourself. I love crafting my own stuff. If you guys watch my videos, I have these shelves on my wall that I crafted myself. I love the idea of doing your own stuff to make something that fits exactly what you need. That feeling of fulfillment and all that kind of stuff. But what I got getting into the show was so much more. It was cute girls. They're cute. They're fun. But what I got was actually just insanely good character writing. This is like Slice of Life 101. I hope that every Slice of Life writer looks at this as a prime example of how to write characters. Because nothing is simple with each of these characters, but yet nothing is over dramatic. Every character has their plot points. They come together in very creative ways. Nothing is easily resolved. Like the whole thing is like, I figured, okay, Putin's going to eventually learn, come by one day, see they're all having fun, go, humph, I don't want to do this stuff. And then eventually somebody hands her a hammer. She hammers something and goes, oh, this is actually great. I want to be with Yuasa Setafu. Let's hammer stuff. No, nothing's ever that simple. And I think the point in which I realize this is that as it gradually went, like Takumin's introduction was cute. She was there. She was doing her craft stuff. She enjoyed it. And then eventually she goes, I wish I can keep doing this. And like, we thought you remember already. It was cute. And then you have the introduction of Jobco, which is again, the foreign exchange girl. Jobco was the turning point. Like when Jobco showed up, I realized how good the writing was because not only does she come in there and then she somehow injects herself into Pudding's home and just kind of invites herself and starts messing with her computer. And then eventually kind of wants to learn both schools' curriculum. But Jobco becomes the bridge between the old and the new, because that's a core concept of the overall story is, again, slightly advanced technology here. You have drones everywhere and AIs, and
it was constantly reminding you that is a thing. Yeah. I mean, through the entire show, you're constantly seeing drones floating by at some point, or
it's Amazon probably.
Yeah. I think it was Smamazon or something. It was one of those random weird versions of the name. But my point is that there it's constantly in your face of this is a just future world. So you're never outside of the realm of the world is different than what you're used to. So these people are not in the mindset of the old, they are in the mindset of the new is commonality. And they don't, there is no, at no point does somebody walk up with a tablet and somebody goes, oh, what is that? How does that work? No, it is just common knowledge that this is how things work.
Yeah, Putin comes home one day and bumps into Setafu and says something like, "What did you learn today? We learned about how to make living usable arteries. What did you guys do?" And Setafu's like, "Oh, we learned about this prince of this kingdom." And she's like, "You're learning about the past and we're learning about the future." And then you watch Setafu's like, "I mean, it's not that special." And she's like, "That wasn't a compliment." And she storms off. Like, again, it's trying to indicate this idea of the old versus the new. Even when Setafu first goes into the do-it-yourself club, she's like, "Well, why would you make a shelf? You can just buy it from the store." And Rey's like, gets furious because everybody says that to her. But it's, again, it's a concept of you can craft your own thing. But again, Jobco was the bridge because Jobco, again, her father is a CEO of a high-tech AI advanced computing technology, whatever company. Whereas her mother, which not to get too in spoiler here, was a different case. And so she can kind of see both sides, even though she is a forward-thinking girl and she does have to kind of get nudged. She is technically the thing that can bridge the two sides. And again, it's not quickly. It's just enough. Just she's kind of like a spy. She's a spy implanted into Pudding's home that eventually kind of nudges things into place. And I really loved how they did that. The characters in the show are so beautifully portrayed. I think Setafu is probably the only one that's gets the least. Maybe Rey is as equal because Setafu is just a creative. She's an imaginative person. She has her head up in the clouds and she's always just thinking about things and how to make things. Again, Putin is just kind of, again, she has her interest in Setafu and wanting the best for her. Takumin being kind of the heart of the group. Kokoro being the strength of the group, Jobco being sort of, again, the bridge of the group, and again, Rey being the glue of the group because she's the leader. She's very patient. She's able to show people what they need to do. She's perfect. I think Rey's a perfect person to be a club leader because she is extremely patient and showing people things and showing that when mistakes are made, it gives character and it gives you a learning experience. But overall, I love the show. I think the characters are fantastic. Beautifully written, perfectly paced, beautiful art, by the way. I think the characters are really beautifully drawn. It's got a lot of creative style to it, very animated. There's quite a few scenes where I thought the animation was absolutely fantastic. The emotion on the characters' faces, their expressions were so beautiful. Pine Jam, dang, you nailed the show. You did a perfect job. The music was fantastic as well, always meets the scenes, just through and through. A phenomenal series, and the ending was absolutely a massive payoff. So I highly suggest it. Again, my favorite show of fall and one of my favorites of the 2022 year. Yeah. Do it yourself. Check it out. Peter Grill and the Philosopher's Time Super Extra. Streaming on High Dive, ran for 12 episodes, 12 minutes each. Wolfsbane and Seven did it. They did it. And directed by Tatsumi, who does a lot of hentai. So you know what you're getting into here. This essentially follows Peter Grill, who's the superhero party, super bestest hero of the world. And he's so powerful. And this means that all the girls want his man butter.
They want to have very, very strong offspring. Let's say it politely.
They want man butter.
No, they want offspring that are very
so tough, literally like every him. Female in the world. Well, let's be honest. Every hot female of every world, every race wants his butter. For some reason, no like unattractive girls come rushing up to him to want his man butter. But yeah, the second season kind of opened up with like this this orc or the goblins attacking. Which yes, if you've ever read any story or like watched Goblin Slayer, you know what that means. But it was kind of funny because they were all female, like mostly we're all female, which is kind of funny. And then his sister showed up, and then the elves had some problems. And then at the very end, what was the very end story? I just watched the other day.
The dwarves.
Yes, right. The dwarf that wanted somebody to fund her research. Your thoughts?
Oh, I'm not sure. The sister ruined a good chunk.
It was hard to recover from the sister.
And that is my biggest beef. Beef.
Because it happens every time we talk about this show, I think.
It's frustrating because I was so excited to have this show back because I really, really liked the first season. And the first few episodes were doing really good, and then the sister happened. And
yeah, the goblins, they haven't had a goblin slayer in the episode. It was
great. I love Gobbico. I thought it was fun. And I was excited about it. And I don't know if it was on a stream or what happened. Andrew had mentioned something, and I said the sister showed up, and it can go one of two ways. And I'm scared of one direction that it might go. And Andrew, I think Andrew at some point said, no, Chris was right when he said that about the sister. And I was like, yeah, I know. It sucks because the sister went the wrong way. Now, did that ruin the rest of the show?
Luvelia's dad. Like, we don't need another one of those. Like, it's just Luvelia's dad. Yeah. He's able to follow him everywhere.
Pretty much. And it sucks because I would have preferred if the sister kind of became this kind of weird flip or something like that and became a part of the harem. I would have probably enjoyed it a lot more. Maybe that might happen in the future at some point. But as it stands right now, the sister was really annoying. I mean, she's like dad on crack. Because she's going to remove stuff and all that stuff. And she became a massive presence, more so than the dad, because it was fun of hiding it from him and all that stuff. And you kind of get this kind of, okay, I can deal with that.
It's the same effect as a Yandere. She becomes the focus because she can't not be the focus because her presence there is dreadful.
But to be fair, after the sister was kind of not necessarily out of the picture, but she was out of the picture, we went right into the dwarves, and it kind of recovered from that point. But there's no doubt that the sister,
well, don't
really
forget about Vigan's episode with her sister.
Yeah, that was kind of fun. But when it comes down to it, the sister did kind of frustrate me for a few episodes, but the rest of it was fantastic.
Yeah, I really love the first arc. The goblin arc was hilarious, and like I said, the goblin slayer, they literally had a goblin slayer in there. Like the dude with the helmet that covers his face, and then all the goblins are attached to him, and he's got the secret way of taking out the goblins. It was just like, that literally is a joke played off the goblin slayer, obviously. But then yeah, it struggled with the whole sister thing. I was kind of shrugged with the whole thing with the elves. As much as I love Vegan and her sister was all right, it was kind of a shrug segment as well. But yeah, I think it kind of at least saved itself a little bit with the last part with the dwarves. It wasn't incredible, but it was just a nice little. I think overall this season was a struggle for me because the first season was like lots of dumb, etchy, raunchy humor around these girls just jumping his gun every 2 seconds, whereas most of the second season was just really him being unable to function. And yes, that technically is to the point of what he's having to go through. Like, he literally can't perform anymore because they keep jumping him. But it was like less funny in that regard, so it kind of lost a lot of its flavor. And yes, I don't remember how animated the first season was, but the second season was rough. Like, oh gosh, rough with the animation. And they had a lot more attempts at action scenes of the second season, so maybe that's why, but it just seemed like it was more visually rough than even the first season, so that was kind of a downer as well. But it's still fun. I still enjoy the series, and was kind of surprised that we even got a second season. So that's Peter Grill and the Philosopher's Time Super Extra. We do need to talk about immoral. Did I put Immoral Gill on the list? We got to talk about, yeah, the Immoral Gill's down here. Encouragement to Climb. Next Summit ran on High Dive, ran for 12 episodes. Unfortunately, like the first like five are like nothing but recaps. But so we got 7 episodes done by 8-Bit. Yusuke Yamamoto did the directing for it, who did Skip Beat and Habano Reme. But yeah, for those who don't know, this essentially follows Aoi. At some point, Aoi is reunited with her childhood friend Hinata, who she forgot was her childhood friend. But a long time ago, they went hiking together, and they promised each other they would go to hike again together, and she forgot about it. Over time, she's kind of met with other people that all go hiking together, and it's just all about overcoming, you know, difficulties and getting stronger and endurance and knowledge about hiking and just having fun together and exploring and tackling challenges. So, but yes, I don't want to get too much about the story. I mean, I guess the big whole point here is I did appreciate the season as much as I was frustrated with the fact that the first five episodes were just literally recaps. And honestly, I don't think they're good recaps. I do appreciate the fact that since the original series, I don't even think is available anymore, it's kind of a necessity. And I'm kind of glad that at least it's there for people to at least watch this and be able to get the whole story. But if you can get a hold of the old seasons, I recommend watching those rather than the recaps. But again, if you have no choice, just watch the recaps. But it was a great season overall. I really loved a couple of the stories, including the coworker of Aoi, where she took her out on a date, and you realize at some point why she invited her was really kind of sad. Kokono's adorable as ever. Hinata was fantastic. Honoka with Kokono was really fantastic as well. And I think the big staple, obviously, with the season was the ending, which is literally Aoi wanting to re-challenge the one thing that she failed at, and I thought it was absolutely fantastic. It was a massive payoff that I've been looking forward to. It was still a massive struggle. I hurt for Aoi. I hurt for her the first time she tried it, and I hurt for her the second time she tried it. It was really kind of an overcoming, and I think that's kind of always been at the core of Encouragement Kaim. It is cute girls having fun together, but it's also kind of non-melodramatic interactions and little childish spouts here and there. I think it was like, what, the third season, they had like this big falling out between Aoi and Hinata, and it was super cute the entire time. You're like, you guys are so cute. Stop being so pouty at each other. They both were like, their schedules didn't match up, so they both did their own thing with their own friends, and so it turned into this jealousy thing between the two of them. It was super cute. But it's really cute, really fun, really relaxing. But at the same time, having these challenges they go through, that you just kind of root for them. You want them to succeed. You want them to get through what they're going through. And as per always, I absolutely love it. So I highly suggest Encouragement of Kaim for everybody. Did you get a chance to finish it?
No.
I'm sorry. I'm kind of semi-spoilering things.
No.
Eventually, one day, you'll get back to it.
Nope.
No, you're not going to get back to it?
I hope I will sometime.
Immoral Guild. Anime of the year, go watch it. Literally, we put it on our anime year list. It was a joint effort between me and Chris to finally acknowledge Immoral Guild. But no, Immoral Guild, for Toko no Guild, this one streamed on no platforms because it's too risque for the West.
It's too no-no for you.
It's too much for us.
You cannot handle it.
Comedy, fantasy, ecchi, series composition by Kazuyuki Furuyasu, who did Slime, Land of the Dill, Encouragement to Climb, Girls Last Tour, MMO Junkie. But yeah, this one opens up fantasy world. You got this guy, Kikuru. Kikuru is, I think they call him Kikun at some point, right? Wasn't he Kikun?
Kikun, yeah, pretty
much. Yeah, Kiku, I'm going to call him Kiku. Kikuru essentially is this Adventure Guild's like only good person. Like he's very skilled and he takes on a lot of jobs. And at some point he realizes once he gets this letter from his friend that he's been wasting his whole life focusing on that. He's never gotten a relationship. He could have gotten married by this point, have children. So he's like, you know what? Look, I got to quit. And the guild mess, the lady's like, no, please don't do that yet. We don't have anybody to replace you. And hey, wait, we have somebody coming in for her first day. You know, go show her the ropes and, you know, just enjoy your time. And yeah, that's Hitamu, who is this kind of beast girl that comes in and she's super genki and she's so ready to go out and start her adventuring. At first, when he goes out with her, he kind of starts to criticize her, like, why would you waste your time being a adventurer? And then he realizes he's just criticizing himself because he did the same thing she's doing. But they go out together to go tackle some bears, and the bear gets a jump on Hitamu and starts to lick her. Does inappropriate things to her. And then he defeats the bear, and then they go back to the guild, and then he realizes very quickly, He's not going to be able to retire yet because this girl's not ready to take on this job because she's useless. She's got hypersensitive senses, so she's able to tell where monsters are, but she's really clumsy when it comes to her own safety, is essentially what it is. Later on, we get the introduction of Maidena, who is a healer that charges people for her heals. We have Toxico, who is a spellcaster who's super lazy, and she's best girl. And we have Hanabata, who is a warrior that has a berserking ability. And that's, they're all dysfunctional, obviously, but they're all super cute and funny. And Kikuru is constantly trying to help them learn how to be adventurers, but monsters keep getting the jump on them and in doing appropriate things to them. Because, yes, there's a story reason later on that this isn't just ecchi. There's a reason why the monsters do bad things to them. Thoughts.
Is there anything else that we need to add to this other than that it's amazing? It's perfect.
It's freaking amazing. I'm so shocked how much I love this show.
This is absolutely brilliant in its ecchi. I had a lot of fun watching this show. Yeah, it's great. Love it. Even the addition of the Red Mage later was pure brilliance.
No, I'm surprised how much this is kind of reminds me of it, and this is probably why it wasn't licensed. It felt very Interspecies Reviewers, and the idea that it's kind of like it's ecchi, but it's kind of borderlining to doing something else. Like the slimes and stuff do some make you it's obviously suggesting things, but it's never H. Like it's not actually H. It's just it's borderlining it really well. And maybe that's why nobody picked it up, but it reminds me like Interspecies Reviewers and the idea that it's hilarious and it's so witty in a lot of the comedy that you do with the ecchi. The ecchi in this show is clever and it's got punchlines to it. And even outside of the ecchi, there's a lot of comedy that's mixed in there as well. Like I mentioned at the very beginning, he's criticizing Hitamu for doing this and then at some point he realizes, I'm literally making fun of myself. And that extends into other characters with their old jokes. Hibata and her berserking ability. Toxico and her removing poisons. the spouts between Maidena and Toxico. Spoilers in light novels jokes. And cooking with Hitamu and the different parts that they cooked. And the part that Maidena cooked and ate. It's hilarious. I was super shocked by how much this show had me laughing out loud. Again, not technically gut laughs. I mean, there was a couple gut laughs parts with this one. But for the most part, every single episode had me laughing. The character designs are fantastic. This is one of the few cases of a quote unquote harem show. They don't spout with each other like a harem does. It's not like Hitamu is fighting with Maidena for Kikuru's tension. It's just all these girls are around him. They each seem like they each have an interest in Kikuru, but that's the extent of it. It's not like a harem fighting with each other over the main character. And this is one of the rare cases.
They got more important things to fight.
Yeah, like the slime monster that's eating at their clothes. this is one of the cases where like I love all the harem members. Like I love every single one. Even Hana, when I first seen Hana, I'm like, I'm not sure if I like her, but then, like, she just gets really cute later on with the whole berserking thing, and yes, her having to, one day we're going to have to explain to her what she does when she berserks, because she never remembers what she does. Only the fact that every time she wakes up, everybody's injured. Especially Kikuru. But yeah, just her, like, freaking out and going, I'm gonna do this! So dorky. But I love him. I love every one of these girls. The doctor inspection episode was just priceless. I love the Toxico episode because it kind of got a little bit serious with Toxico's episode because they had this whole spider hunting they were doing. And it turned into like one of my favorite scenes with Toxico where she had to remove the poisons from his body, which was super spicy. And I loved it because I love Toxico. But yeah, it's just through and through fantastic. One of my other favorite parts was the whole aspect of where they were they were trying to fix Hana. And he was out there with the guild lady, and at some point, Hana, like, literally sandwiches him between... He's sandwiched between the guild lady, who's, yes, endowed, and Hana, who, yes, is endowed. And at some point, Imona is like, we have to express to her that it's not good. And so she's like, Hana, he doesn't like this. And then Hana's like, really? And And he says nothing. And there's like this like 5 second pause. And then and the guild lady's like, Kikaru. And he's like, oh, yes, don't like this at all. He's literally sandwiched between four mounds. It's great. This show is just fantastic. I absolutely loved it. I hope that, that's a sad thing. Like, you remember there was a company that was such a great company. They went out of their way to license Interspecies Reviewers, and they gave us the release of it that we deserved. Now that company's no longer around, really, to do this one, too. But hopefully somebody picks it up. Maybe Discotech or something. I would love a Blu-ray. It was priceless. It was super priceless. So, anyways, that's Emerald Guild. Fantastic show. All right, moving on. We have Mob Psycho 100 third season. Yes, it is finally over. I think this is supposed to be the final season. Somebody will correct me, but I'm pretty sure it's supposed to be the final season. So it is over. It is completed. Really great ending to the series. For those that don't know, what it's essentially about a boy named Mob who has psychic powers. He's really incredibly OP. But something happened when he was younger, so he decided that he did not want to use his psychic powers anymore. And also his childhood friend, who he's really interested in, that goes to his new school. He really wants to get her attention, so he's trying to do a lot of like self-improvement. He ends up joining the bodybuilding club and everything. At the same time, he ends up running into a guy named Reagan, who is a con man that runs like this psychic helping service thingamajiggy, and completely exploits Mob's psychic abilities for his own gain. He claims that he's a psychic, but he's actually not. And Reagan becomes kind of a father figure to him and takes care of him, even though he was originally just pretty much exploiting Mob. And we get into the third season, we had like the aftermath of the second season with this big broccoli tree thing appearing in the town. It starts to cause problems. You have cults being created around it. They're looking for the one that created it, which is the depiction they have is pretty much Mob. And Dimple does some crazy stuff, and it all kind of wraps up in the end with kind of a little bit of Mob's own self conflicts that he has about his psychic powers, which, like I said earlier, was a pretty good tie-in with the whole story overall. Kind of just, you know, bring it full circle with the original story. So as I said, I made a whole video talking about how I wish I was madly in love with this series. I'm not, and I think that's much to the disappointment of a lot of people. I think my video I did pretty well in kind of describing my issues that I have with not being madly in love with it. I do enjoy it. I think the second season was incredible. First season I didn't like. Third season I'm kind of mixed on. There's a couple things that I was a little bit rough on, but overall, in the end, I think it wrapped up really well. Like I said, I think the final arc, even though there was one character that was somewhere that I don't know why they would be there in the wake of everything that was happening. But other than that one thing that kind of sticks out like a sore thumb, like I said, I think it was a really good wrap up for the story and kind of put a nice bow on the overall story of Mob. So I think if this is in fact it was a good ending. Typically with stuff that runs for so long, you know, nailing a really good ending is kind of difficult. But I think this one really pulled it off. I still don't care for the character designs and the visual design. I think the animation is incredible. But yeah, overall it was a really good ending to it, and I'll leave it at that so that I don't say anything that will make people mad, because Mob Psycho fans really love their stuff. I don't know, when I made my video, there was a lot of people that were like, yeah, I absolutely love the series, but I respect your opinion. So it's not that like all Mob Psycho fans are crazy, just some don't like me for not loving it. Which I think is one of the struggling things. It's always a struggle with certain series is where you don't find it. And I mentioned that in my video. It's one of those series where I see how much people love it, and it's like, I wish I could see that, and I can't. And it frustrates me. It sucks being the outside looking in.
I didn't watch it, so it's absolutely show to me.
You weren't the outside looking in. You were in another country,
yeah.
And you were on the phone.
And I believe it was a perfect show.
You were on the phone with me going, so how's it looking? I'm like, it's looking really good. Yeah. And you're like, well, I'm nowhere near you.
I don't have to worry about nobody getting mad at me because it's a perfect show.
Reagan, in the end, is the best character by far. I absolutely loved Reagan. Again, it took me until second season before I fell in love with him, but my gosh, Reagan was a great character. That's end. But I'm going to stop. Mob Psycho 100 Season 3. I'm going to stop before I say something that I'm going to regret. Let's talk about an amazing series that Chris absolutely could not stop talking about at its end, which is Izaki-chan Wants to Hang Out. This one streamed on, I don't know why I have Funimation on there. It was probably on Funimation too, but it was on Crunchyroll. Ran for 12 episodes. ENGI is the studio. And yeah, this one follows a guy named Shinichi Sakurai, and he goes to college, university. And at some point, a year in, he gets this new class comes in, including his past kohai, which he used to actually be in a pool, a swimming club with back in their previous school. His kohai starts to go there because she's a year behind him, which is Uzaki. And yes, Uzaki, it kind of starts out where Uzaki's kind of doing her own thing. She's like, hey, what's up? You know, hey, how's it going? And then she kind of does her own thing. And then eventually she realizes that Sakurai doesn't have any friends. He's always kind of a loner. So she decides to take it upon herself to annoy the hell out of him and talk about how he's a loner and drag him off to places constantly just to so he doesn't be a loner. She feels sorry for him. And then, over time, he gets annoyed by her. They get into shenanigans. Ecchi happens in the first season. And then the second season, pretty much it turns into a why do they not see it season where who's going to acknowledge. I think from Uzaki's perspective, she was convinced Sakurai loved her. And from Sakurai's perspective, he was just oblivious. I think that's kind of the gist for the most part. I mean, it shifted here and there, but
yeah, it shifted.
And the cat kept watching.
Yeah.
From a distance. And then, we meet pretty much all of Uzaki's family. That becomes, like, a big part of it. We finally met Sakurai's family for, like, a brief episode. And then it goes back to Uzaki's family. Uzaki's mom believes that Sakurai is trying to hit on her and not her daughter. The father her father is, like, a manager or something of the workout place that he goes to because he wants to clear his mind. And the brother keeps thinking that whenever the mom teaches Sakurai how to cook all the extras they have left over, he believes that it's Uzaki's girlfriend at the school. So he's obsessed with eating the food until he realizes it's Sakurai. And then the little sister of Uzaki, at some point tries to push them by hitting on Sakurai.
Yeah. The little sister joined in the
Team Asai and Sakaki.
I loved the show. I loved the first season, loved the second season. I really enjoy the between Hana's absolute taunting laugh, kind of her the way she talks. I just absolutely enjoy every bit of it. The story overall, this is the funny thing about this season. This is a writing thing. And so I want the story that the writer wants to write, to come out. And so in a way I'm in of two minds. I of course love the story and I can't wait to see more of the story, but at the same time, I felt this season felt like the biggest bait of all. I going through the first season, you get this kind of, there's this limit of how far they want to push the storyline. In the second season, it really felt like they were kind of, like Andrew was kind of mentioning, they were hinting at to Hana that she needed to kind of push forward. If she didn't push forward, she was going to lose Sakurai. And then at the same time, towards the middle of the season and into the latter part of the season, then it kind of shifted to Sakurai is starting to acknowledge his feelings for Hana. And so, or Uzaki-chan, for those of you who don't know her first name. This kind of shifting kind of left this, for a lack of a better term, it felt really baity. I would have been fine if they had, you know, kind of dragged the first season out into just more of the kind of tease all the way through. But with this kind of hinting that they were starting to acknowledge their feelings, you kind of felt like you were going to get a resolution to that. And I really walked away at the end of this season. And unfortunately, I'm ending up spoiling it for that matter. I didn't get that resolution. Now, did they kind of reset it? Not really. They both are now in full acknowledgement of their feelings. So, but at the same time, they did kind of get to this kind of neutral point at the end of it. So you're kind of left with this feeling that if they do go into a third season, we're going to be back into this at least second season, if not back into the first season, as far as just the back to the thing. And you can't never go back to that. You really can't. You are now at this point where if they don't acknowledge soon this relationship between the two of them, people are going to be frustrated. I can see that for sure. So take that for what it is. Other than that, I still love the show. I absolutely love the characters. I love the goofy hijinks that all these characters get into, and had a lot of fun.
I'd be happy if they went back to season one. Just reset back to season one. No, I hated season two. Like, I don't think there was... I mean, like, I got a kick out of the whole mom thing, with the mom thinking that he's literally after her, not the daughter. But the whole thing with him actually calling her Suki because he couldn't call them both Uzaki. So in recognizing this, when he was in the presence of the mother, he decided to start calling her by her first name, and that set Hana off. Other than that, like, I don't think any of this season at all worked for me. Asai got annoying, which she was great in the first season. The father and the daughter, the bar owner and daughter kind of thing. They were great, and it didn't work for this season. And I don't think really, besides, again, the whole thing with the mother, anything really worked comedically. I think what made the first season so great was that it was like a mixture of like the ecchi humor, which was really good ecchi humor. It wasn't just ecchi for sake of ecchi. It was ecchi with a really hilarious punchline. The whole thing with her getting in the bush and him having to pull her out of the bush and people walking by and thinking they're doing something. That kind of stuff was hilarious. The whole aspect that something oopsies would happen between the two of them and Uzaki wouldn't punch him immediately was really refreshing for that type of show. And just everything was working really well. And every now and then having these little cute, you know, is there something doki doki happening between the two of them every now and then just kind of pop up and surprise you. That's what made season one great. Season two got rid of all that. There was like literally no ecchi in the entire season, besides maybe the whole thing with the family going to the pool place, if you want to say, you know, with bikinis is ecchi, or swimsuits is ecchi. Then they had one moment where they had dress up moment with Asai forcing them to dress up Uzaki and stuff, and then thought of, you know, mom getting involved with that stuff, and that was pretty much it. And so it's like all the ecchi was removed. I felt like it wasn't really funny besides a couple segments, and it just really turned into meet the parents and will they, won't they, for like an entire season. And it was just with no real payoff in the end, just felt like a big waste of time. So the only reason I was continuing going is because I was figuring, like you, that it was kind of building up to something. So I was going to suffer it without, like, with the sheer lack of comedy that was kind of in the season. Maybe it just wasn't working for me this time around. That could be possibly it. Maybe it worked for me in the first season, didn't work for me the second season. But in the end, it didn't really have any kind of payoff, so it felt like I just kind of struggled through something with no real reward at the end, which was really unfortunate, so.
And the frustrating thing is I acknowledge the SI club or whatever you were calling it.
Team SI.
They were the whole point of that was the acknowledging your view from the outside, in that you were seeing them and their interplay, and they're trying to make fun of the fact that you have these expectations. And I fully acknowledge that was a lot of the comedy for this season, was noting that we are expecting them to figure it out. And then it was almost like they were making fun of you in the fact that you're expecting this, but this is not really happening. Oh yeah. Well, we're the ones that we watch it from the outside, just like you. And it's almost like,
and the cat face pops up.
And I don't care about the stupid cat. Stop talking about the stupid cat.
The cat is the mangaka. Isn't that what it's supposed to be? Isn't the cat supposed to be the mangaka?
Probably.
That's like at the very end. You get trolled at the very end, and guess mm-hmm. what pops up? The mangaka going, oh,
yeah, you thought I was going to do that. And it's so in a way, to me, it almost comes off as mean-spirited. Almost like, we got you again. And so take that for what it is. It's frustrating. You have each one of them have their own aspect. Like Ami is kind of this... was she the one who was forcing the two, and Satsuki doesn't, or no, Satsuki wants to force them. Ami doesn't, the bartender definitely doesn't want to intervene. So yeah, each one of them has their own aspect of kind of pointing out the flaws in your thinking on what they're doing. So yeah.
Yeah. So, Ami is just kind of super pervy, and Itsuhito is just kind of, he's a wingman. They're both into them getting together. Just one goes at it more normally, and the other one goes at it more drooly mouth. I also have to say, Studio ENGI, I think it was still Studio ENGI, learn how to do architecture. That stupid cut to Uzaki's house, which literally popped up every single episode, it fixed the stupid blinds. The blinds are... they're not blinds. It's a screen door cover, and for some reason you act like it's a blind hanging off the side of the balcony, and it doesn't make any sense. There was so many. Turn it like this stupid. Where's one of those pictures where what's wrong in this picture? Pictures, and like we started pointing things out. It was like, this is actually technically wrong. There's like a whole bunch of things wrong in this picture, and they used it the entire season. Anyway, this is Aki-san wants to hang out. What was it called? Like W or something like that.
It's probably for the cat face type thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's totally for the cat face. It's totally not for something else. Totally not something else. Management of Novus Alchemist is our next one. This one's streamed on High Dive, ran for 12 episodes, done by Studio ENGI. Source is a light novel, fantasy, slice of life. The director is Hiroshi Ikihata, who did Magical Circle Guru Guru, Tonikawa, Under the Moon for You, or Over the Moon for You, or something like that. Seiyuu Life. Series composition by Shigeru Murakoshi, who did Gymnastic Samurai, Quitting Heroing, and Zombieland Saga. And yeah, this one opens up with a girl named Sarasa. We find out very quickly her family used to own this one shop, and they were going on travels, and between deliveries of their goods on this cart, they end up getting attacked by bandits, and they were all killed, and then this group kind of took over the company from them, shipped her off to an orphanage because her family was gone. And at the orphanage, she decided to work really hard to kind of rebuild the thing that her parents had. And she studied really hard. Then eventually some alchemist kind of came by and was talking to the children at the orphanage. And she asked, you know, look, can I become an alchemist? And she's like, yeah, go to this one school. Make sure to have good grades. So she goes to that school. It's a school that kind of allows anybody, commoners, orphans, nobles. She goes there, aces her exam, even though they goofed up. They didn't want to say anything because they goofed up, and it would look really bad if they said anything. And in the end, her shisho ended up kind of helping her find a shop, which was like out in the middle of nowhere. But hey, it was a really cheap shop, and her master paid for it. So kind of this girl who's not really social because she's been her whole life kind of studying and not really socializing with people, now having to learn to socialize because now she has to open the shop and meet the villagers of the town, and she's really afraid that they'll look down on her because she's basically still young, and she has some really big shoes to fill because they had a previous alchemist there. And so she has to learn to trust and to meet people and to gain confidence in herself as she builds her own little shop and gets a cute little lolly to help take care of the shop and manage it and eventually save the life of some goofball and put them in extreme debt with her so that they have to help her gain materials all the time. And her shisho is really amazing.
Pretty much.
Thoughts? Oh yeah, she one shots big fiery bears.
Something like that.
Yeah, fire bears.
Um,
no fire bears.
I really enjoyed this show. I've always been kind of big on the whole Atelier series, and having an anime based around that idea was a lot of fun to have. I really did enjoy a lot of kind of this. Every once in a while, it kind of got into this not dark, but it did kind of get into the more grayer area where it was kind of playing on the idea of, how do I put this? It forced something that you could go, okay, this could be dark if they went down that path, but it never did go into the dark realm. It just went right there to the edge and said, this is something that's in that area where you go, okay, I see that, but it doesn't, it keeps it lighthearted and kind of just forces the issue and says, look, this is something they're facing. But we don't have to go that far. So I did enjoy that they kept it realistic and still kind of stayed in the light side. So all in all, I really enjoyed a lot of the goofy things that they went through. At some point, we token to what Andrew was mentioning. At some point, that we had a revelation that, yeah, she's actually as OP as they made her out to be. And at the same time, they kept it reeled in so that it wasn't something that she relied on a lot. It still was there. She could use it when she needed to, but they kept it to where she didn't become this massively overpowered, just take over the entire world with her superpowers. And towards the end of it, we got this kind of storyline where they went back to her roots and, kind of touched on that a little bit and how she was going to.
I was presently surprised by how they handled her going back to the roots. I thought that was, it didn't turn into like what I had expectations for oh my gosh, here's the villain. But no, it wasn't. It was just completely different. I don't want to say exactly what it is, but it was very surprising how much that was really well handled.
I enjoyed that.
She had a really screwed up childhood.
Yeah.
Her parents just dying and people ripping off her entire franchise and kicking her to a curb.
So yeah, I liked how a lot of that worked out, and I all in all I came on came out away from it enjoyed, and I think it's a solid show.
He came around to it, enjoyed. That's a new one.
Mm-hmm.
I like it. It was a little bit of it sounded like a flub, but it actually makes sense. That's always it's a good save. No, I think overall the show was a pleasant surprise. I think coming into it, I was like, okay, here's kind of going to be like the low budget throw together anime selling some weird franchise. Probably not even going to do that well. You even wonder why they even bother adapting it. We did, yeah, obviously both me and Chris, I think, had some positivity coming into it because it like literally the light novel came out like a month after Atelier Thaiza. And so you obviously know what they were kind of going for there is to really bank on Atelier Ryza and that popularity of the Atelier franchise. And so there was expectation coming into it was, okay, cool, an alchemist anime. What can they do with this? And I think early on they did a pretty good job of kind of introducing the mechanics, introducing Sarasa, her terrible childhood, and how hard she worked and how she struggled. I think my favorite moments were really kind of seeing her rise to power, getting her place that she can, you know, do her work at, and really just how she interacted with the people of the village, how she felt like she was underskilled, that she wasn't ready. She feared that everybody looked, you know, didn't think that she could pull it off. And then eventually kind of proving herself, and not just proving herself to other people, but more so proving herself to herself. Because honestly, most of the people were very welcoming. She just didn't see it. And how they kind of played all that stuff was really good. Then the Fire Bears happen. That was a terrible episode. Just didn't like the whole, it just randomly out of nowhere says, okay, we're going to do this whole thing because Fire Bears are coming. Everybody get ready. I got a plan to fight the Fire Bears. They set up this whole thing and it just turns into her running around slicing everything in half. Like, she just turns into a super OP character that teleports everywhere and slices everything clean in half in a split second. Then that was done. I'm like, okay, good. We're done with that. Move on. And then beyond that, there was some fun little moments kind of going out, gathering resources, which I figured was kind of happen again, similar to the Atelier series. You have to go out and get your materials, but there was an emphasis kind of placed on the fact that she had to kind of rely on people around her and other gatherers to go out and get materials. And And I really did like how they got into the intricacies of the importance of the materials she uses. Nothing is cheap. Nothing is free. They hit it on it heavy with Idis Lotz. She was like, she came in with a missing arm and she was dying. And so she had to say, well, how are we going to do? Like Sadasa basically tells them, how much do you want me to save? And they're like, why would you even ask that? Well, and they go into they eventually get into details about it. Like, yes, I can restore her, make her, you know, I can help her survive. That's easy. I mean, we'll just do a little bit of this, a couple of these medicine bottles, and it'll be this fee. But when you're talking about putting her together fully, reattaching her arm, and making her whole 100% again, that takes all of these materials, which means I can't use those materials for other people that get injured. That means I have to go recuperate all this stuff. All this stuff costs a fortune. It costs, you know, they originally talked about she got this book series from her Shisho, and it took forever to put that book series together. It was that cost. Like, it was a massive amount of money. I mean, this is like similar to going to a doctor. If you go to the doctor with a cut on your finger, it's probably really cheap. They put a Band-Aid on it, you're good. If you go to the doctor with your finger cut off, it's going to cost a ton of medications, you know, anesthesia, the reattaching it, sewing it, all the materials there. Everything costs money. And it was nice that it was, like, respectful of that. Yes, guys got angry, like, why are you putting a price tag to her life? But it's like, yeah, but I have to replace these materials. I go out of business. Like, you have to – everything costs money. So there was a little bit of emphasis over the time of the series that they really put on the materials, the risks that the gatherers have to go through. The risk involved with getting certain things where you could technically die gathering it, like the bats. There was these bats that collecting their teeth was extremely dangerous because if you even touched the tip of the tooth, you'd freeze to death instantly. And so, yes, technically gathering those teeth, there's a grave danger to it. You have to pay a substantial amount for it. And so that was kind of something they've got into over the time, not in like crazy detail and not constantly, so it never like bogs down the show. But it was nice that they kind of put emphasis on that kind of stuff. And this kind of led into them developing on different things. And I think that was kind of the parts where I really did appreciate the later parts is finally getting into the books. Because like early on, that was my intrigue was like, oh, well, I wonder if they're going to actually do the books. Again, the books that her Shisho created was like 10 volumes of alchemy. And it's just like the beginning is easy stuff like potions. But then as it goes along, it's like trinkets and artifacts and stuff like that. Like the bag that she put all the books in was like this bag of like unending. So it's like you can put a whole bunch of stuff in there and it's got elements added to it to make the weight less. That's the kind of cool stuff that I was hoping they would kind of get into. But they only really kind of scratch the surface with all that stuff. It's like a bean net thing to cover your face from bees and a cooling hat so that you don't overheat and that kind of stuff. Like I said, so like there was a lot in the middle section that was kind of hit and miss. But I think, like, the beginning was really fantastic. The later parts of it, especially getting back into her history, stuff around her Shisho was always fantastic. And I think it kind of wrapped up pretty well at the end with kind of a task that she was very uncertain that she'd be able to kind of handle despite the fact that she's a massively overpowered main character with no limits to her capabilities. So, yeah, like overall, it's like it was a pleasant surprise, but I can't deny that there was... there was some missing points. Like not every episode was a really good knock it out of the park episode. Some episodes were kind of just shrug. I did appreciate a lot of the chemistry. I think Idis most of all was just an absolute dork. Her attacking the fish eel thing and getting electrocuted just made me laugh out loud. But Kate didn't. They didn't really do much with Kate, did they? Did I forget something? I just feel like she was just. I mean, she was just there.
Was she the one that they... No, it was Idris that they Idris were coming back
her
to
family,
get.
Yeah, they were trying to take her away.
No, I don't... I guess... I mean, they were...
Unless they implied Kate was involved with that whole situation, because I know her parent, both their parents came over.
Right.
I don't know. Anyways, that's management of... I'm sorry, novice alchemist. I got yelled at for that. I'm supposed to say novice, not novice.
Oh,
I've heard both ways. I thought
novice
it was like a tomato tomato thing.
I would have pronounced it. So
you said novice.
Mm-hmm. That's how I would have pronounced it.
Well, you're a novice, so you would never know that it was novice. Raven in the Inner Palace. This one is streamed on Crunchyroll for 13 episodes, done by Bandai Namco Pictures, based on a novel. Genres are fantasy, mystery, drama. Director was Chizuru Miyakawa, who did Gintama. So there you go. This one opens up in kind of like this feudal Japan kind of era. I think it's actually in China because every of the names are all Chinese. So there you go. But no, we're in this one empire. And in the opening segments, we have this guy that just kind of gains enough favor of all the guards and everybody to essentially rise up as the prince, the rightful prince, to take the throne back from the Emperor Dowager or Empress Dowager. And after kind of kicking her from the throne and locking her up, he's trying to find evidence as to what the Dowager had done to his mother, because his mother was killed. So he's trying to find evidence that she was connected to it. At the same time, he is basically trying to employ the help from what they call the Raven Consort. In this inner palace, you have lots of these consorts, and there was one that's kind of isolated from everybody. It's not even supposed to see the Emperor himself. And that is Jusetsu, the Raven Consort. She's locked up in this one place in the inner palace, and the Emperor goes to her. Now, this, unlike all the other consorts, is she doesn't see the Emperor. She doesn't do nightly doozies with him or anything like that. She's just supposed to stay there and isolate herself. But she's known for having certain abilities. And so he goes to her to see if she could possibly find out any information about what happened with his mother. So that kind of starts the relationship between the Emperor and the Raven Consort. As the Raven Consort goes out, does like a lot of different investigations. So people will come to her and ask her about, like, we've seen this ghost in this one area of the Inner Palace. And she goes there and tries to figure out what happened. And a lot of her skills and abilities have to do with the ability to speak to the ghosts, spirits that have not passed on. So she'll have to figure out what caused the problem so that she can find a way to resolve it and send them on, or just get them to go away. I guess there was one where it didn't really send them off. And that's kind of the gist of it. And we get more information as it goes on as to what the Raven Consort is about the previous empire that was essentially the current emperor. His father or his grandfather took over the empire from this other race.
I don't remember. It seems like it was the grandfather, but
I think it was. Yeah, I think it might have been grandfather. But anyways, the previous empire, the one that was taken over before. More about them, the Raven Consort. But yeah, I'm really disappointed that Chris didn't finish. I understand why. Don't get me wrong. I'm saddened because this was definitely a gem of last season. So what was your thoughts on the first few episodes?
I loved it. I absolutely loved the
you loved Jusetsu, right?
Yeah, I really
so
loved
it. Tell me about Jusetsu.
I like the interactions between the Emperor and her. I absolutely love the addition of Juju and a lot of the stuff involved with that. The mysteries were absolutely phenomenal. In a lot of cases, they were very touching. I think one of the last ones that I watched was the Songbird episode, and how that was kind of one of those misunderstandings that ended up happening. And I really did like a lot of that. I think it was touching and just fantastic. It was one of the ones that it was really hard not to get back to, but it was, as the weeks kept going by, it was really frustrating and I wanted to get back and I never could.
I think the main thing that this one, the Raven in Their Palace, what it excels at, I think, is just purely, it's not a mystery in the idea that you're trying to figure out what happened as Jusetsu's figuring out what's happening. It's more of a thing where Jusetsu's kind of, through conversations with different, you know, ladies in wait and stuff like that, she figures out what kind of happened. And then once that has been discovered, it's more about how Jusetsu resolves the situation in the end, I think, is the greater part of it. So it's not really a mystery that you're figuring out, but it's really you're watching Jusetsu figure it out. And I think the reason why it works so well is that this writer is so good at interweaving character developments and the developments between Jusetsu, the Emperor, getting information about the Emperor and Jusetsu, all while resolving those situations. They interweave these stories so that, like, there's not an episode where it just opens up with, there's a boy ghost on the bridge, let's figure it out. And they go over and they go, oh, poor boy ghost on the bridge, go home, and it's done. It's always like, okay, there's this boy ghost that's on the bridge, And then we're learning about Jusetsu, we're learning about the Emperor, and then they come together and they figure out the situation. And then, oh yeah, by the way, a little bit more progression on Jusetsu and the Emperor as their relationship. It's always doing something with the characters at the same time that this is there. It's just, it's kind of like, that's an excuse for them to come together for a brief moment while they advance their characters. And I, like I said, that's kind of where the gold comes in the writing for the series, that I never felt like a single episode was just, oh, this was just about this ghost. That was a throwaway episode. It never, every episode felt fulfilling in how they kind of progress the characters and their stories. And it really does help that they're, the overall story, especially with Jusetsu, is extremely advanced because her backstory is incredibly intriguing. Probably the only issue the series has overall is that technically it's not 100% at the end. Like, this is an ongoing story, and it really does feel like that was the biggest tease, was that it tried to ramp something up at the very end, and then it kind of cut it off very, very abruptly. And then it just kind of ended the series. And it almost felt like they shouldn't have done that. Like, they teased something really big about her and what she's tied to at the very end, mainly the Raven Consort. They teased it really heavy at the end and then just cut it off. And I don't really feel it was necessary. I'm probably sure it's necessary for them to sell novels, but it almost felt like a stain in the end. Because I think everything they presented with Jusetsu, the Consort, the aspect of the Raven Consort was all really well put together, especially like the moment they kind of have her come out there and throw out the scroll that was given to her by the previous consort. And it tells like this massive story about the Emperor and how the Emperor is tied to the consort. Basically the Winter King and the Summer King. I think it was the Winter King and the Summer King. That whole aspect, it just kind of the cycle of tragedy that they're trying to fix. So it makes perfect sense why the Raven Consort is so isolated. And it, yet at the same time, it sucks. Like, it still in the end sucks that this is even a thing. And that whole aspect of that is super tragic, but at the same time puts so much weight upon Jusetsu as a character. By far, Jusetsu's character developments was, besides healing, and besides, was it Tokoko from Hikei Story? The big sister from the sister from Hikei Story. Besides those two characters, I think Jusetsu is probably the one of the best wrote characters last year. Oh yeah, probably Tisato and Takano. They're probably right there alongside Jusetsu, because Jusetsu is one of those characters where she's fully isolated. She doesn't like people coming in there. She was told by the previous consort to never get involved with people, never want for something, because, again, there's a backstory to that. But you see her slowly opening up her shell, slowly coming out of that shell, and she has to learn how to really interact with people. She makes Juju angry at some point because she doesn't know how to respond to what Juju wants to do for her. And seeing her have to slowly learn to interact with people, despite the fact that she keeps acting tsundere with the Emperor coming in, he constantly gives her things. And I think it was really genius how they handled the Emperor, because he comes in there and he goes, here's this thing. And she goes, why are you giving me this? I just want you to have it. And it's always something like a sweet or something like that that she ends up enjoying. So she's experiencing new things through these little things that he's bringing her. And she keeps bickering about how she doesn't want it, but she always takes it. And then over time, it gets to like these other trinkets and gifts and stuff like that. And you're slowly seeing that her opening herself up. And I think they did a really good job of, again, slowly doing that. Her interaction with the other consorts and stuff were just really good. I really did love how they developed her character, and it just kind of adds to her character and her goofy, pouty faces, the many faces of Jusetsu's, as we says. It was really good, and the music was fantastic. The ED was, my gosh, I love the ED. Every time, listen to the ED. It was just a really beautiful world, beautiful art style. Jusetsu looks absolutely incredible. Yes, a lot of the male characters kind of look kind of plain, but for the most part, I love all the designs, the artistic direction, how they portray the scene, the setting and everything. I think the negatives I have, like I said before, teasing the overall story at the very end, I felt like that was just unnecessary, especially with the fact they didn't do anything with it. It felt like a source material bait, and it left a sour taste in my mouth. And this is more Crunchyroll's question marks fault. This is another one of those examples where I really hate that they decide to use the original names rather than what the Japanese seiyus are saying. They kind of did the same thing with Thunderbolt Fantasy.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that the Japanese seiyus are saying, like, Juju or something like that, it translates to something else. Like, Jusetsu, they put something else there. It's like, it's never what the seiyus are saying. So while I'm absolutely fluent with Japanese, but I understand some of it. And so whenever I hear a name being put in between dialogue of Japanese that I kind of understand and it doesn't match what's on the subtitle, my brain just breaks and I go, what are they saying? And from my perspective, I think the Chinese names are very much more difficult for me to learn, especially when I'm not hearing it phonetically said. That's kind of more Crunchyroll's fault or whoever translated, or maybe the studio told them to do that. I don't know. Probably not. It's probably Crunchyroll. They probably thought they were being so fancy by going, we're going to actually use the original Chinese novel names. Probably. Who knows?
I don't know.
Anyways, yeah. Fantastic. Love it. Really, really a hidden gem last season. What else do we have? I think Utuwara Mono is our last one, right? Yep. Our last one is Utuwara Mono, which is the third and final season of it. It's finally over, Chris. I'm going to guess.
I never did catch up.
Oh, how far did you get? I figured you dropped
way back.
I think you were like, what, 8 episodes into the second or third season or something like that? Because I think we talked about something that happened there. But yes, we're the third and final season of Utuwara Mono. This one is The Mask of Truth. We, of course, had the first season was the original Utuwara Mono. The second season was The False Faces, I think it was.
Yep.
Yeah, False Faces. And then this third one was Mask of Truth. It's been pretty much, 2006 was the original season, 2015 was the second season, and now we're finally getting the conclusion of it, and I have to say, I was pleasantly surprised with how things kind of wrapped up.
Mm-hmm. They pulled it together?
There was one aspect at the very end that I wasn't too happy with, but I can't really say anything about it, because it'd be technically massive spoilers, but... essentially what kind of happens in this third season is you have essentially Haku takes up the mantle from, Oshitaru. And what kind of comes from that is that he has to lead the armies to essentially get Anju, who is the rightful crowned princess of this kingdom, back to the throne because they decided to replace her with somebody, a fake. And it kind of turns more into once that kind of happens. Well, I think the majority of this first segment is really kind of gathering the forces. It's a lot about going around, finding, essentially going to each one of the members that he's found. Because over the course of, I think, the entirety of False Faces, it's him meeting different people of different cultures. So you have Atsu, he's from this one kingdom. You have Nozori is from this kingdom. And so he's going to each one of them and trying to gather them together to follow the rightful crowned princess.
And that's pretty much how each one of them have worked out. They go from place to place building up armies, and eventually you get to this ultimate
battle. I think the reason why it was so different with the original one was because that was kind of like if I remember correctly, it was like that was an ongoing process. It was this constant push away from something, and they were gathering forces that way. Whereas this one, and admittedly, I didn't like it. False Faces was a lot of them coming to him and him just getting the harem. False Faces was the only part of the entire Utuwara Mono series that I did not like. It was the earlier segments. Anyways, that aside, third season... What that kind of turns into is, yes, the big fight, and then it kind of quickly shifts into the more deeper, what Utuwara Mono does eventually, at least the first season did. It gets very grounded in the history, the past, where everything kind of came from. And it's nice. The reason why I like it so much with the final parts, even though I don't necessarily agree with how everything goes, I can't argue with really anything mechanically, I guess. Because everything sort of fits what they've kind of established. I don't see plot holes, I guess is the best way to put it. I'm not happy with a certain thing kind of popping up out of nowhere at the very end. Because it feels almost like that, no, this is the bad guy. Which, again, makes sense. But not necessarily who triggered it, I guess is the best way to put it. This was always existing, and it is the bad guy. And it is really bad, but I hate the fact that this person triggered it, I guess. Towards the later part, it really did feel like, all right, we got to make sure that we cover this part. Okay, don't forget, we got to make sure that we wrap this part up too. So let's just pop that up there out of nowhere. So other than like things just popping up out of nowhere as like, let's wrap this part up. This is an evil bad. We need to make sure that we wrap this part up. It put it together. I hate how badly this is sounding because it's me trying to be vague about this stuff. In the end, I think it wrapped up really, really well. It felt very true to the original Utuadamono in a way. And I think the characters all had their moment to shine in the very end. And I think the ultimate conclusion in the end was pretty satisfying. So in certain ways, there are other ways it was not happy. In other ways, it's not happy. But I've always, for Utuadamono as a series as a whole, like I said, there's certain parts of second season I didn't like, or False Faces. But overall, I think Utuadamono is just one of those fantasy stories that you just don't ever get much of. And I think it's a fantasy that's done really right, because it's not just about magic. It's not just about fairies and dragons. It's about a mystical fantasy world that is a living, breathing world with many nations, many political powers, the struggles that each of these countries go through, essentially the weakest of the weaks coming together to build a force strong enough to fight against those that are of power. And that's how the original series was. Again, something that I didn't really see too much in False Faces, but ultimately came into fruition with Mask of Truth. It has always been about protecting the weakest, rising up against the powers that is causing problems, and ultimately in the end, the equal power that each person has if they come together. And again, I think they successfully nailed it with the ending of this, and in the end I was very much so surprised. So
I've always been impressed with the sheer scale of this fantasy world. It's one of those that this is one that I will eventually get back to. I love this series so much. First season, second season, or first part, second part, and this part, I was absolutely loving this show. It was a time crunch on this one. And the scale of it has always been, epic in grandiosity. I mean, it's just massive. And
75, what? No, it's like 80 episodes, isn't it?
Pretty much.
Yeah, we're on 80 episodes or so.
And what it does is it starts out with something simple. Like in the first season, it was Hakuro and him just learning the village that he wakes up in.
The amnesiac protagonist, Chris.
Yeah, he's an amnesiac protagonist. So he has all the reason in the world to fight massive battles over that. But yeah, he just slowly builds up this group of pretty much misfits and eventually turns them into this band of fighters and eventually an army and eventually that
Toka. Don't forget Toka and Chris. Toka,
yeah, because Toka. She is ultimate.
Toka's the best girl.
No, Araru and Araru are the best.
Araru and Araru?
Yeah.
Araru and Araru?
Then the baton gets passed off into the second season, and then you get into Haku and him going through all these... not Haku, it was... was Oshitoru?
Yeah.
Or did Haku go to eventually meet Oshitoru? And that's him. Where we were discussing...
He was one of the pillars of the emperor.
Right. And then you get this kind of baton passing between the two, and the only issue that I've ever had with Utuadamono is at the end it does this kind of unveiling of all these secrets of the world, and they've never really been solid in how they've explained that, and that has always been kind of the biggest frustration that I've ever had. And did they at least solve that in this one?
That's what I mean. They went out of their way to make sure that every kind of issue was addressed in the end. But that was like I was saying, where it almost felt like at some point they're like, oh crap, we almost forgot about this thing. Okay, let's bring that up too, because we've got to make sure that we resolve that too. Like I said, it technically got into everything. And I kind of agree with you, because what kind of happened with the original season, it was kind of pretty clear what they said in the very beginning with the ending of the first season. It was like, oh, here is the backstory. This is this thing. All right, tragedy, end. And it kind of made sense, and so you kind of accepted it. And then we went into the second season or False Faces. It was like, all right, so where are these people at? Like, you're looking for where's Hakuro? Where's Eridu? Where's Aridu? And it almost felt like, okay, I guess we're doing something different, but it technically has the same lore. I mean, we see the slimes and all that kind of stuff, and you see the masks, and you're like, okay, whoa, Oshito has a mask. What does that mean? And then it starts to, again, kind of dive into the false masks and all that aspect that was going on. And I was really surprised because it didn't take very long into False Faces before Haku gets taken off to the side and says, oh, this is how you're tied into everything. There's this backstory stuff again. Here's this history of the world again. And then here's how you're tied into it. And I was really surprised how early it did that because it adds a little bit of confusion to the original story and the backstory. It was like, okay, but what does it have to do with Hakuro and stuff like that? And then it gets into later parts where it really, again, gets really deep in that stuff. And like I said, it all sort of makes sense to me. It's one of those ones where I'd be afraid of making a full video on it just because I'm sure I probably get something wrong or I misstate something. But it is one of those ones where in the end, I feel like I understood everything. But at the same time, it is one of those ones you could probably deeper dive into it.
Yeah. I mean, when I finished off the False Faces, I was so frustrated with the ending of that. And that led me back into my frustrations with the first one. The Hakuro's version of it, that it was so frustrating. It was like, what is it about this backstory that they're missing so badly?
I think it's really for us how long it's taken to tell that story. If you think about it, it was way back in 2006 when the first series came out. And so when the second series came out, I don't think I even went back and recapped it. I just watched that one. And I don't think it was until we got into this season that I went, yeah, I gotta, we're now going on what, 16 years since the original season. I gotta recap. So I went back and I kind of speed read, watch, skip through some scenes just to check out those one scenes where they got the backstory stuff, just to get myself kind of reacquainted with the stuff. And so it kind of helped, and it kind of makes everything make sense, but there are still a lot of names and a lot of groups and a lot of races and a lot of characters to really follow with the series. So it is one of those ones where if you look at it pretty surface level, you're going to be confused by a couple things. I'm talking to people here. But if you love deep diving a lot of this stuff, there's so much stuff to eat up.
Well, my thought was maybe it was just because I was getting it there, the anime version of a, you know, all the information, and maybe it would be better if I went and actually played the game. I thought about going and playing the games, but
yeah,
the idea of playing a couple hundred hour game.
Because what they did is they did False Faces, they did Mask of Truth, or they did the original visual novel was the original Tuatamono, which confuses me because I remember I was pretty sure a certain character was based on two different people that didn't end up being the case with the later parts. But anyways, they made False Faces, a tactical game here recently, and then they did Mask of Truth, and then I think they went back and they did the original one with the same engine. So I would love to get those three games, and I would totally play through it because I agree. I can probably see a lot of this stuff being a lot more well developed in the
game. Yeah,
especially a lot of the character interactions and a lot of the side stories with all the characters. Because I'm sure, like, these single episodes that were given to like Nozuri and her kingdom, and giving into Atui and her kingdom, I'm sure are much more fleshed out in the actual game. So I can see that. I can see that. But in the end, I love the franchise. I love the character designs. Right. My gosh, I love all these character designs. It's basically a world full of animal people, and every single tribe has like a different style of it. So like with the original, was it Tuskaru? They have like a more downward kind of droop to them, where they have other groups that have more upper droop of the ears and stuff like that. Whereas yes, technically Haku and Hakuro were like the oddity of the world because they were technically human. Or they looked like humans. They had human ears. So that was always kind of the interesting thing. But I always loved all the character designs. But yeah, fantastic. And It's still technically, what was it, White Fox or something like that. And they did a really good job of the series. There was a couple of uses of CGI, but for the most part, some really good animation there. I mean, this is a studio that did things like ReZero. So there's hit and miss points. But overall, I think they did a really good job of it, which is really surprising me because I don't really know how insanely popular Utuwadamono is in Japan. But obviously, it's somewhat popular, or they at least have a passion for adapting the entire story. So I'm really happy that in the end, despite it taking so many years, we got a full adaptation of it. I would love to go back to it maybe in a year or two and just rewatch the whole thing.
Yeah,
and
that is definitely something I would really love to do.
Yeah. At some point, I made a video saying, I think it was during the time of the Mask of Truth, is trying to get out there to say, is anybody else watching this? Because I really love this series, and I hope other people are giving this attention because it so deserves some attention. So, and the other sucky thing is that it's like all over the place. Like one season was on Funimation, one season was on HIDIVE, and one season was on Crunchyroll. I think now two seasons are on Crunchyroll. Hopefully Funimation moved it over, but it was very difficult to find it everywhere. But did I have the DVD? I want to say at some point I bought the DVD of the original.
Did you?
I hope so, because it's going to be hard to find here soon. Anyways, that's I swear I did, because I think I ripped some of the footage off it at some point for a video. It's probably somewhere. If it was available, I had to have grabbed it at some point. But yes, if you're looking for a massively long, really amazing, very much so centered around territories and kingdoms and essentially rise from the villages rising to fight against power and crazy fantasy stuff and super OP cute girls with gigantic swords and katanas and chicks with gigantic swords that mow down groups of baddies and
just about everybody is overpowered as all get out.
Cute animal girls and tiger riding lollies and fairy girl with Rikujimiya voice and it was Rikujimiya, right? Wasn't that Kamiya?
I don't remember.
I think it was Rikujimiya. Yeah, it's fantastic.
They got my Tama in there somewhere.
Yeah, and they technically had a lot of haremy feels with the original series, but I think, like I said, it gets pretty haremy in that second season. So if you like lots of bath scenes with guys, you get lots of bath scenes with guys. I think I made a joke about that a long time ago. It's like, yeah, we got a lot of bath scenes with them guys. It's a lot of fun. Really great characters. My gosh. Oh, gosh. There was a lot of crying towards the later part of this third season, though. I gotta admit, there was a scene with Kuon being reunited with somebody that got me teary-eyed. Obviously, Nekone. At some point, Kuon had to address something with Nekone, and it broke me. A lot of teary-eyed moments towards the later part, so it got super emotional. Good stuff, though. Good stuff. I highly recommend the series, and you'll know in the first season. Yeah, you should definitely watch the original series. Start from the original series and go up. But within no time if you're going to enjoy it. The OP will sell you enough.
I think it's very much worth it. It's one of those few shows that, despite its frustrations, it's very much worth it. It like I said, it is epic in scale. And when you start to realize just how epic this story is, you'll know why it is such a. I mean, I guess the best way to put it is, it's a fantasy version of Gundam. I mean, it's just that massive. It's just so huge.
Fantasy version of Gundam.
Yeah. I'm going to get so much hate for that statement.
there is giant fighting things here and there. Haku, get in the Gundam. Haku, get in the Gundam. Anyways. But yeah, that's our reviews for the fall 2020. Fall? Yes, fall 2022. Yes. Okay, Andrew, I'm tired. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Always, we're at TalkingSpear.com. That's where you can go for all of our links to our social media, ways that you can support us through Patreon or Tips link. We also have our links to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/otakuspirit. Please go there if you get a chance and subscribe to the channel. We're almost 10,000. I've promised a room tour at 10,000, so force me to have to take time to do that, because I said that I promised to drop everything to do it once that happens. Also, you can become a member there. You can sign up and join and support us on YouTube as well. And you get some unique stuff there. If you normally do YouTube stuff, you can get unique stuff there. But yeah, we hope you guys enjoyed. We also have a link to our Discord. We have a great community of people. Jump on there. You can chat. I don't know if Chris gets on there anymore because he's so busy, but I try as much as possible because Chris is busy.
Yeah, I poke in every once in a while.
He just goes to the non-safe for work so that he can make sure nobody's breaking the rules.
I'm going in there to go and see all the Bochy stuff.
There's so much Bochy stuff in there. Thirsty Bochy boys. That's what I could call them now, is Bochy boys. Anyways, we hope you guys enjoyed, and y'all take care.
Os.